Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. This episode follows a slightly different format. You, the listener, will be getting two shows in one episode. I've teamed up with Jamie and Amity of the Bone Palace Ballet podcast to tag team the issue of child abuse and neglect while looking at two notorious cases. If you follow us on Twitter, you may have noticed that in October, we began discussing collaborating on this episode. You see, it just so happened that October 26th of this year marked the 51st anniversary of the Sylvia Likens murder. Our true crime community was all abuzz discussing this crime on Twitter. It still makes even the biggest true crime aficionado sick. So, after a few weeks of ironing out some details, we finally decided to bring this episode to our respective audiences. I will cover the Likens case, while Jamie and Amity will be looking at the modern parallel of the Erica Parsons murder, and some of the psychosocial machinations behind these behaviors. With that being said, on behalf of the True Crime Fan Club and Bone Palace Ballet Podcast, we hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, on to the show. July 4th, 1965, Indianapolis, Indiana. After a night of singing Beatles tunes with their newly acquired friends, Paula and Stephanie Beniszewski, Sylvia and Jenny Likens woke the next morning to their father, Lester, bartering with Paula and Stephanie's mom, Gertrude. He was asking if he could board his girls with her while he and his wife, Betty, traveled the carnival circuit for work. The life of a carny was notoriously nomadic. They were not going to lug around their five children, so boarding them was easier. They had done it before with relatives, friends, or even strangers. This type of negotiation was not out of the ordinary for the Likens girls. They settled on $20 a week. He ensured her that her payment would arrive on time every week. He also left her with some regretful advice stating, "You'll have to take care of these girls with a firm hand, because their mother has let them do as they please." Gertrude Beniszewski was a 37-year-old single mother of seven children. In her lifetime, she endured 13 pregnancies, with six of those resulting in a miscarriage. In order to give off the impression that her children were not born out of wedlock, thus making them illegitimate, she went by her husband's last name, Wright. Gertrude, despite barely making ends meet, agreed to take on Sylvia and her sister Jenny, who she believed would not be a demanding boarder due to her disability. She wasn't focused on ensuring the girls were well taken care of. She was focused on increasing her meager income. Yes, she received money from her ex-husbands, although the child support payments were severely delinquent. She did laundry for customers and even babysat neighborhood children. But that was not nearly enough to care for her family. To add to her struggles, she was aware that her 17-year-old daughter Paula had been impregnated after having an affair with a married neighbor. Gertrude was not in a good way, especially health-wise. She was stressed out, had chronic health issues, which caused her to appear as if she was simply skin hanging off the bone. Her eyes were sunken, her hair was thinning and falling out, and her face was gone. This makes Lester's decision to board the girls with her ever more puzzling. Perhaps it had to do with the times. It was 1965, and the mask of humanity was slowly being pulled away, and monsters were being revealed in everyday people. Gertrude was just another monster waiting to be revealed. Her home was filthy, by all accounts. It was not large enough to accommodate the growing brood that she had or the additional two boarders that she agreed to shelter. The majority of the surfaces were covered in thick layers of dirt. The pantry was relatively empty, and there were not enough beds or utensils for the nine occupants. She made do, and now Sylvia and Jenny would too. They didn't really have a choice. The girls were enrolled at Technical High School, where Sylvia was social with her classmates. Stephanie and Paula welcomed Jenny and Sylvia into their social circles. Gertrude would take them to church on Sundays. Sylvia enjoyed singing with Stephanie and Paula in their room, and she was beginning to enjoy her time there. The girls both stated that Sylvia was humorous and enjoyed going to church, and that she was fiercely protective of her younger sister Jenny, who had a bout with polio when she was a young child. They noted that Sylvia would do her best to make sure that Jenny was spared any struggle. The second week of their stay began, and Gertrude was missing something. She double-checked the envelopes, and she was certain it wasn't there. The payment Lester promised her would be on time was not. Incensed and filled with rage, she ran to Sylvia and Jenny and screamed, "I took care of you two bitches for nothing!" Sylvia and Jenny were confused and terrified. They had not seen this side of Gertrude before. She ordered them upstairs and told them to lie across the bed and pull their underwear down. She was going to show them what happens when she's taken for a fool. Sore and humiliated from the spanking, the girls did their best to fly under the radar. The $20 that Gertrude was expecting arrived the next day. Their parents would stop by for a visit, and they would make no mention of the beating they endured a few days earlier. The Lykins left again, and the girls were under the will of Gertrude. One day, on their way home from school, Jenny and Sylvia went through some garbage to look for glass bottles. They had done this in the past just to scrounge up a few cents to get some candy. They made enough to buy a bag and entered the home, where they were promptly questioned by Gertrude. She assumed that they had stolen the candy. It wasn't a surprise. Their mother had just been arrested for shoplifting, so naturally, the children must have been following in her footsteps. Sylvia explained how they earned the money, but Gertrude was not going to hear it. She was a thief and needed to be punished for stealing, and now for lying. She was again made to lie across the bed and paddled on her bare bottom. Sylvia's punishment was only just beginning. The children attended a church social that following Sunday, where Paula, whose mean streak the girls had not yet come across, reared its ugly head. She reported back to her mother that during the luncheon, she saw Sylvia gorging herself on food. This was understandable, knowing what little food was in the house. Gertrude was so angry that Sylvia was attempting to ruin her slender physique. Why it mattered to her remains unknown. Perhaps she was just singling Sylvia out and trying to find any excuse to do so. Or maybe she was jealous that Sylvia was everything she wanted to be. Young, healthy, beautiful, having no responsibilities. These are the things that Gertrude wished for herself. She also enjoyed hurting the girl. That was obvious in the harsh punishments doled out for menial infractions. But how was she going to punish Sylvia for overeating at the church social? She boiled a hot dog and forced each of the occupants in the house to load it with condiments. One by one, each person added a new condiment until it was grossly full. The hot dog was given to Sylvia, and she was forced to eat the disgusting concoction. It's no surprise that this caused her to vomit. She was ordered to clean it up by eating it. A few days later, her parents would again visit, and neither of the girls made mention of the hot dog or vomit incident. Many speculate that the girls failed to speak up because they feared they wouldn't be believed. Whatever the reason, I'm not entirely convinced, considering the mentality of spare the rod, spoil the child that dominated that era, that the girls would have been believed or taken seriously. So in some way, it's understandable why they didn't speak up. August would bring new waves of punishment for Sylvia. Sure, she was used to the spankings with the paddle and often took them in the place of her disabled sister. This didn't prevent Gertrude from punishing both of the girls, but Sylvia seemed to be her main target. the punishment she was facing progressed from Gertrude being the main abuser to her involving others in her sick pleasure. After overhearing Sylvia tell one of the girls that she had once allowed a boy to slip under the covers with her and feel her up, Gertrude flew into a rage. She accused Sylvia of being a prostitute and told the rest of the house that she was pregnant. Sylvia was a whore now, and Gertrude had reason to treat her like one. She would start by continuously kicking her in the vagina. After she was done, Sylvia attempted to regain herself and tried to sit down in a chair. Paula pushed her before that could even occur and yelled, "You're not fit to sit in chairs," which was odd logic considering she was the one having a child out of wedlock. The next day, Sylvia and Jenny decided to fight back, the best way teenage girls know how, by gossiping. They told their classmates that Paula and Stephanie were both prostitutes and that they had actually seen them having sex for money. Coy Hubbard, who was Stephanie's boyfriend at the time, caught wind of the rumor and where it originated, and he set out to set the record straight. But first, he needed to take care of Sylvia's lying loose lips. He arrived at the Banaszewski home later that day and told Gertrude what he had heard. She encouraged him to make things right and to beat Sylvia up. He did just that and would often return back to the house to use Sylvia as his judo dummy. In a sworn statement, he said, "I went over to Stephanie's house and I flipped Sylvia on the floor. I think I did this because of something she said about Stephanie. About 2 days later, I went over and Sylvia was in the tub taking a bath. Gertrude asked me to go upstairs and tie her to the bed. I went up and I tied her hands and feet. One other time, I burned her with a match." Gertrude would encourage other kids in the neighborhood who visited her home to hurt and abuse Sylvia or gawk at her wounds. Paula, her daughter, seemed to take after her in a way and began hitting Sylvia with anything she could get her hands on. She often threw dishes, bottles, or cans right at Sylvia's head. And on one occasion, after hitting her so hard in the jaw, Paula realized that she broke her own wrist. Despite this abuse, Sylvia continued to persevere in a way. She held on to hope that she just had to hold on long enough until her parents returned. The burns from the cigarettes would heal, and the paddling would stop. The judo practice would cease. But her parents never came. Sylvia would be pushed down the stairs in many different ways. They would hold her hands behind her back, and then push her, or allow her to walk freely as they walked behind her, and then push her down that way. A neighbor by the name of Phyllis Vermillion moved into the house next door. She arranged a barbecue in order to get to know her neighbors. She invited the Banaszewskis. Sylvia was walking around the party with a very noticeable black eye. Paula saw Phyllis looking at Sylvia and boasted, "I gave her that black eye." She then filled a glass with hot water and threw it right in Sylvia's face. Phyllis witnessed this and remained silent. She would continuously be hurt or harmed in some way by all members of the household, including her sister Jenny. Jenny would punch her in the face at the direction of Gertrude. If she failed to comply, she would get punched in the face herself. Sylvia, in order to protect her sister, encouraged her to punch her. Sylvia's spirit was slowly fading. She was mostly quiet and timid now, a stark contrast from the girl she was before, bubbly and humorous and outgoing. It seemed as if she was always waiting for the shoe to drop. Was she going to get slapped, punched, kicked, burned, or pushed down the stairs today? Can you imagine that state of fear? Take just a few seconds to imagine Sylvia, who was so full of life just 2 months prior, beat down in such a short amount of time. The fact that Gertrude could convince so many people that Sylvia was a thief, liar, and whore. But not only that, she was able to convince them to set their humanity and conscience aside, to harm their friend or to watch their friend be harmed. Even if they didn't consider her a friend, they should have at least seen her as a human being. Sylvia still managed to get around despite her appearance, which means that more than one person saw the state or condition that she was in and said nothing. Despite this, she was outside again, looking for Coke bottles to sell. She just wanted a few dollars to be able to buy her and her sister some candy or a Coca-Cola. She returned to the house with cash in hand. Gertrude saw this and accused her of getting the money from prostituting herself. The boys were all in the living room just talking. She dragged Sylvia into the living room and forced her to do a striptease for them. Confused, she soon understood why Gertrude was requesting this of her. She told the boys what Sylvia had been doing. She was embarrassed and crying. But Gertrude wasn't done. She handed Sylvia her empty Coke bottle and told her to stick it up her vagina and pleasure herself, since she was a slut. It was now October, and Sylvia began to lose control of her faculties. Perhaps it was as a result of the multiple kicks to the crotch, which had now become uncomfortable and swollen, or perhaps it was constantly being pushed down the stairs. She was malnourished and worn down. She began wetting the bed. When Gertrude discovered the soiled bed, she banished her to the basement. She was no better than the dog, and that is where she should stay. She didn't deserve the clothes she had, and if she was going to be wetting herself, then she might as well not have them. She was left nude for days at a time, and tied to different posts in the basement. Paula told her she wasn't allowed to use the restroom, thus making herself soil again. If she did urinate or defecate on the floor or in the waste bucket, Gertrude and Paula would make her drink and eat her own waste, thus causing her to vomit, which they would then force her to eat again. To clean up the dirty girl, they would drag her to the bathtub and tie her up. They would then pour scalding water on her, causing her skin to burn. Her wounds would then be treated with salt, which Paula especially enjoyed. Sylvia must have thought that Gertrude softened the day she allowed her to go back upstairs and sleep. She was given one stipulation. She had to be tied to the bed, and was told, "You can't go to the bathroom until you've learned not to wet the bed." She, of course, wet herself again that night. Fed up, Gertrude made her repeat the Coke bottle and striptease all over again. She was still very angry at her for spreading those rumors about her girls, and wanted to make an example out of her, saying, "You have branded my daughters, so I will brand you." Ricky Hobbs, a neighbor and friend of the Banaszewski girls, often participated in hurting Sylvia. He would burn cigarettes on her, held her hands when Gertrude burned the tips of her fingers for stealing. Today, he was eager to accept the task assigned to him. They were going to give Sylvia a tattoo. The crew drug her down into the basement, stripped her naked, and tied her up. Gertrude heated a sewing needle and carved "I'm" into her stomach. She handed the needle to Ricky and told him to finish the job. Sylvia had bit through her bottom lip so hard that it had severed. Jenny came down and saw what was happening to her sister. She was horrified to read, "I'm a prostitute and proud of it," carved into her stomach. Another one of Gertrude's daughters, named Shirley, began to carve an S into her chest. She told Jenny to finish the job, but she refused. She had seen so many terrible things happen to her sister. She witnessed her eating her own feces and drinking her own urine. She was sickened by this. She had told her sister Diana of the abuse Sylvia was enduring, but was ignored. She knew Phyllis Vermillion had witnessed on more than one occasion Sylvia being beat by Paula. Still, no one helped. She witnessed many neighborhood children pay a nickel to throw her sister down the stairs, or gawk at her naked body, or burn her with matches and cigarettes. Help never came, and she was not going to participate in this final torturous session. When the crew went upstairs, she knelt down by her sister and held her hand and told her that she was going to be okay. Sylvia simply said, "I'm going to die. I can tell." She was allowed back upstairs and given a nice warm bath, a stark difference from the scalding hot water bath that she had gotten in the past. She was forced to pen a letter to her parents. It read in part, "To Mr. and Mrs. Likens, I went with the gang of boys in the middle of the night, and they said that they would pay me if I gave them something. So I got in the car, and they got all they wanted. And when they got finished, they beat me up and left sores on my face and all over my body. And they also put on my stomach. I am a prostitute and proud of it. I have done just about everything that I could do to make Gertie mad and cause Gertie more money than she's got. I've tore up a new mattress and peed on it. I have also cost Gertie doctor bills that she really can't pay and made Gertie a nervous wreck and all her kids." Despite her state, she overheard Gertrude tell her son John and her sister Jenny that they were going to be responsible for dumping her body in the nearby waste lot. She knew that she needed to escape. She got up and ran towards the door, but Gertrude grabbed her by the hair and dragged her back inside. She sat her back down in the kitchen and gave her some toast to eat. She told her, "I can't swallow this." This infuriated her, so she grabbed a curtain rod and began to beat her across the mouth. She told John to take her back to the basement and tie her up. She didn't want her to die in the house, so she tried to offer her some crackers in an attempt to keep her alive long enough to dispose of her later. Sylvia defiantly told Gertrude, "Give it to the dog. It's hungrier than I am." And Gertrude repeatedly punched her in the stomach for this remark. October 24th, 1965. Gertrude was done. It was time to get this wretched being out of her life. She and her son John beat her over and over that day. She swung a chair at her, but it broke apart in midair. She grabbed the paddle next and swung it at her, but it swung back around and hit her in the eye. Coy Hubbard, who had used Sylvia as his judo dummy in the past, grabbed a broomstick and hit her across the head. She was out cold. It was over for Sylvia, and she knew it. The next morning, she was taken upstairs to the bath. Stephanie and Ricky realized that she had stopped breathing and attempted to give her CPR, but she could not be revived. Gertrude told Ricky to go to the nearest payphone and call the cops. When the police arrived, she immediately handed them the letter that Sylvia was forced to write. It was her get-out-of-jail-free card. This would all be easily explained away because the letter proved that she was a prostitute. Jenny reached out to a nearby officer and whispered, "Get me out of here and I'll tell you everything." She arrived at the police station and gave a chilling account of the 3 months of torture that her sister endured. The autopsy revealed that she had over 100 cigarette burns to her body, various second and third degree burns, severe bruising, muscle and nerve damage. Her vaginal cavity had swollen shut. Sylvia's body did not betray her, as the coroner stated that her hymen was intact and that her anal cavity had not been ripped or torn in any fashion. This completely discredited Gertrude and Paula's claims that Sylvia was a prostitute and was pregnant. The official cause of death was brain swelling, internal hemorrhaging of the brain, and shock. Only 5 people would face punishment for the murder of Sylvia Likens. They were Gertrude, Paula, John, Coy, and Ricky. They each attempted to shift blame to their co-defendants, but were unsuccessful in convincing the jury that they were not guilty. In fact, they were all found guilty of the charges brought against them. Paula would be convicted of second-degree murder, but appealed and was granted a new trial. Instead of facing another jury, she opted for a plea deal and pled guilty to a lesser offense of voluntary manslaughter. She served just 3 years before she was paroled. John, Coy, and Ricky were each convicted of voluntary manslaughter and sentenced to 18 months in juvenile detention. Ricky Hobbs, upon his release, suffered a mental breakdown and became a habitual chain smoker. This caused him to lose his life to cancer at the age of 21. Gertrude was convicted but appealed and was granted a new trial. She was found guilty a second time and sentenced to 18 years to life. She was up for parole in 1985 and was granted release. This shocked the community and the surviving Lycan sisters, who petitioned the court to revoke the parole. She stated in her parole hearing, "I'm not sure what role I had in it because I was on drugs. I never really knew her. I take full responsibility for whatever happened to Sylvia." She would die of lung cancer in 1990. When Jenny Lycans found out that Gertrude passed away, she clipped her obituary from the newspaper and sent it to her mother with a note saying, "Some good news. Damn old Gertrude died. Ha ha ha. I'm happy about that." Stay tuned for the Bone Palace Ballet's coverage of the Erica Parsons murder. You won't want to miss it.
Hi everyone, welcome to Bone Palace Ballet. This episode is our crossover with True Crime Fan Club podcast. You just heard the first episode on Sylvia Lycans, and our case episode now is going to just kind of expand a little bit on that and bring in a second relevant case that's a bit more modern and look at some of the psychology and some of the potential motivations and issues behind these kinds of behaviors. When there's child abuse, people know, people are complicit and participate, particularly the family members and the siblings as well.
Erica, where do we start?
This is a particularly, I mean, they're all depressing, mm-hmm. but this one really, just as a kid who, you know, understands some of this coming from a dysfunctional background and sort of witnessing some things, these are, you know, the cases that really just extra just make you want to kill mm-hmm. yourself. They're just so sad and tragic. So do you just want to talk about Erica and give you some case particulars and then go into some of your research and stuff?
Yeah.
Do you want to start off with anything before we...
No, I do want to just talk a little bit about connecting the Sylvia Lycans case to mm-hmm. our case. As Lainey said, you know, Sylvia Lycans, she was abused by strangers who were supposed to be like surrogate parents.
Right.
And that's going to kind of come into the Erica Parsons case because her abusers were also not her biological parents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sylvia was also singled out. Like, Erica was singled out. There's other siblings or family members in both cases. And these two particular girls are singled out.
Right.
So there's a lot of other similarities, but just to start out, those are why we kind of thought of these cases together, because there are a lot of similarities.
Yeah, and it's one thing that the parents are abusing a child and no one knows, you know, within the direct family, and it's kept very secretive, and you're almost indoctrinated to maintain that. But then it's another thing entirely when there's that active, again, complicity and participation, and so thinking about why the siblings would do that and how it just, you know, it's fascinating. Horrible, but fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, and both, like, we're not talking about little kids either. As with the Lycans case, her surrogate parents, let's just say, the people who are supposed to be looking out for her, they had, like, teenage, siblings, like Gertrude's mm-hmm. kids and kids' friends and whatever. I mean, these aren't children, per se. They're, like, teenagers. And in the Erica Parsons case, you also have the siblings being urged and kind of cheered on mm-hmm. to help in the abuse And they did so. Right. And they were also a little bit older.
Yeah, her brother was a teenager.
So that's kind of interesting. There's a very clear similarities that I think are important. Mm-hmm. So, Erica Parsons, let's get into her case.
So, Erica Parsons, her overview, in 2013, now we're talking about South Carolina, 15-year-old Erica was reported missing by her 19-year-old adoptive brother, James. So, he told police he had not seen Erica, in fact, since 2011. So clearly there's a couple years gap there. He waited and finally came forth. So at that time, James told police his parents had killed Erica and put her in their backyard. He later recanted that statement. And of course, the police immediately decided to investigate. Erica's adoptive parents, and we'll get into the family lineage because that gets really complicated and confusing, but their names are Sandy and Casey Parsons, and they told police that they had, in fact, given Erica away to a maternal grandmother in 2011.
Can I quick say, is Sandy or Casey, like, which is the man? Or Casey's
the
mom.
Sandy's the man, yeah. And Sandy's Casey's the wife.
Because
yeah.
That, like, messed me up for a while.
And they're so similar, yeah.
So Casey is the mother, Sandy's
the
mom.
Okay. Right. Okay. And these are both completely adoptive, and I'll explain what the actual link is there, but... So upon the police investigation, Sandy and Casey told police that they had given Erica away in 2011 to a maternal grandmother named Nan Goodman. However, the problem was there really wasn't any such person. There was a maternal grandmother by that name, but she actually had been dead for like 5 years. So they said they had basically taken Erica to McDonald's. She really enjoyed spending time with her grandmother and wanted to live with her. So they decided that would be the best course of action. And then, you know, somehow they lost her phone number and she wasn't on Facebook anymore. And they knew where she lived, but they had never been there and she had moved. And so basically, you know, there's no kid. Yeah. They're coming up with this crazy story.
And we'll get into this later, but the whole time they're collecting these benefits.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
They're collecting these benefits because Erica was perceived to be mentally...
She had developmental disabilities, yes. And she was partially deaf.
Right.
So she did collect benefits from the state.
And also a quick link to Sylvia Likens, of course, her... the people that were supposed to be taking care of her were also collecting money. So there has to be... I mean, that link's pretty clear. That was a motivator for them to collect money for these girls... that they obviously didn't care about at all and were, in fact, abusing. But, you know, Casey and Sandy knew Erica was dead for years and collected all these benefits. So.
Right. Yeah. So they continued. I mean, and their excuse for that, they basically said when they were asked, well, why didn't you report if you have no contact with her and you don't know where this Nan Goodman is? And they were like, well, because we were still providing for Erica's insurance, you know, that's how we just kind of kept collecting the benefits because we needed to make sure. And meanwhile, the girl, you know, she's gone. She's been gone for years. So just in the overview, the end result of this is both of the Parsons, because of that benefit fraud, basically, even though they knew they did not have the child, they hadn't had it for years, they were both arrested for benefit fraud and are currently serving prison time for those charges. But there was a major break in the case. So that whole time, right, she was just considered a missing person. They've been looking for her. Her biological mother was trying to find her. Billboards, FBI, everybody's looking for Erica. Excuse me. So in September of this year, Erica's father, Sandy, made a confession to police. And information is still forthcoming. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't really sound that it was a plea bargain necessarily, but we'll see how that shakes out. But he did confess, not that he killed her, but he confessed that she was dead, in fact, and he knew where the body was because he was the one that buried her. So he was let out of prison to go lead police to her shallow grave. Of course, it was a shallow grave in Chesterfield County, South Carolina. And she definitely, it appears, and again, we're waiting on autopsy report, but she had been dead at least from 2011.
So she's skeletonized?
She's skeletonized. Yes. Poor child. Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's just a general kind of overview of, you know, this child is ostensibly missing. And she's been dead in the shallow grave for years, essentially. So who was Erica Lynn? In 1998, when she was 2 weeks old, she was taken in by Casey and Sandy. So they'd had her. Her whole life, essentially. They already had 3 biological children. So the complicated sort of familial stuff is Erica is the biological child of Sandy Parsons, so the adoptive dad, Sandy Parsons' brother's wife, Carolyn Parsons. Mm-hmm. And Carolyn Parsons...
So her aunt and uncle essentially became her parents and vice versa.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. But the aunt has no biological, tie. It's just through marriage. And if you've seen the interviews with the biological mom, Carolyn, Erica's mom... basically the story was that she didn't have the financial wherewithal and the resources to take care of her. And that's why she gave the child away to have a better life. And when you see the mom talk, like, I get that. Like, I can kind of see where she's coming from.
Yeah. And she's giving it to
family. She was trying to do the right thing. She already had children and she couldn't take care of them properly. So at least, you know, she tried. She was trying. So again, like we said, Erica's partially deaf and has developmental disabilities. Sandy Parsons, Erica's adoptive father, has a fifth grade education, which I thought was interesting.
Really?
And apparently, he seems very deferential to the wife, but then he's been arrested for assaulting Casey, the mom, as well in the past. So just very, I don't know, there's a lot of
violence
in that
family. Which kind of makes me think, like, the adoption process, like, because that was a bit rushed. But, I mean, it takes a long time.
Yeah, it's a very complex process.
And lots of lawyers and, like, checking shit out. And it sounds like this one, they were just like, oh, you guys want to take care of them?
Yeah,
and,
like, the two-week-old.
2 weeks later, they have this kid, and they don't seem to care about the assault charges, their financial means, all the kids they have. They don't, like, that was shoddy.
Swept under the rug, yeah. And that continued.
And they're totally complicit in what happened.
Oh, my God. They are disgusting.
Yeah.
So, as things go on, and she's brought up, Erica's brought up in this family with the Parsons, people start, you know, there are signs that things are not right in this house. And so, at one point, DCS was called in to do an investigation because Erica did have bruises all over.
She was going to school,
for a time. And then she was pulled out and she was homeschooled.
Oh, yeah, that's also another.
You'll never leave the house.
I read so many studies about abuse rates of homeschooled children. That's like a whole thing.
Yeah.
That is a whole thing. I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's astounding the amount of studies that are on abuse tied to children that are homeschooled, which is really fucking scary.
When it makes sense. Like, and I'm sure there's a percentage of homeschoolers that are fabulous and wonderful, obviously.
Especially with, like, religious, like, for instance,
it's whole
where we
isolatory
live.
Thing.
Like, Mennonites, especially, are, I mean, we have a whole section in our library for their materials because they homeschool almost all their children. So,
The child's isolated, you know?
Oh, totally.
You're hiding whatever you're doing or not doing. They don't have any recourse. They don't have social skills.
No one to tell.
I mean, it's pretty fucked. Yeah. So that kind of helped, I think, insulate all the things that are going on. But at any rate, there was a brief investigation. But at the time, child welfare closed the case. They didn't.
Ew.
Yeah. The Casey said, her siblings are really rough with her. And that's why she has bruises. And so nothing happened. Okay. So time goes on. After Erica disappeared, however, and the investigation was really underway and people were like, oh my God, where's Erica? Then everybody started coming out of the woodwork and sort of saying, oh yeah, well actually, let me tell you what I know about the Parsons and what's happening in this family. So everyone clearly had an idea, but again, it's one of those, you know, don't ask, don't tell kind of situations.
So, when you say everybody, like, who do you mean?
Like, extended family, outside of the family. Like, they knew. I mean, they knew.
Oh, yeah, I did read a little bit about that.
Yeah.
They were assholes about that. Like, a lot of them, like, you know, they would come visit or whatever, and they would notice that she's malnourished, has bruises all over. And her mom just says some shit, like, oh, she got a wrestling match with the dog.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, nobody gave a shit about
because
this
they raised dogs, too, and hedgehogs, which is just bizarre to me. Yeah, if you
go
on the Wayback Machine, you can see their, like, awful website for selling, I want to say they sold pugs and hedgehogs.
No,
so
course.
That's a whole other level of fuckery.
Of course.
But anyway, so at one point, so again, after the fact, all this stuff's coming out, Casey had even given Erica to her sister, stating that she couldn't really deal with Erica's behavior. She didn't want to snap. She didn't want to kill Erica.
I did read that, yeah.
Yeah, so the sister temporarily, and it's like, so you just accepted that and then you gave her back?
Like
what
did
you think was going to happen?
You get homicidal urges. Here, just take her back. Yeah.
Right.
This poor fucking girl.
And there had been a lot of bad blood for whatever reason between Erica's biological mom, Carolyn, and Casey Parsons. Mm-hmm. Casey really seemed to hate her.
She did.
And I don't know.
And I also read some things that Erica looked a little bit more like that.
Yes.
Her mother.
So it was a physical reminder.
So Casey,
focused that rage. Yeah.
Singled her out again because obviously she has disabilities and, her behavior drives me crazy. Well, she's in need. Mm-hmm. Like she needs special care, not singled out in abuse.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, since she happened to look like her biological mother, who Casey hated, that made her even single
her
out.
That on.
Yeah, made her even more furious at Erica for existing, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So Erica was just speaking about Casey Parsons' sister, Ashley. Erica had gone to live with her twice over the years. So in summer of 2004, when Erica was six, and that's when she recalled the statement Casey making, I sent her away because I didn't want to kill her. Ashley also said that Erica was treated like a little slave, made to stand in the corner for long periods.
And why didn't Ashley go to the police? Because she's a piece of shit.
Yeah, apparently.
I mean, she's an adult.
Apparently.
Oh, my God.
Even to the point where Ashley noticed that Erica's fingers, because something that Casey would do would be basically to break Erica's fingers mm-hmm. by bending them back. And then, obviously, you're not going to go to the hospital. So she would kind of make her own little cast
yeah.
for this.
Mm-hmm.
And Ashley, the sister, knew that. Erica wasn't allowed to play with other children because she was often being disciplined. But she's not the only relative that noted that. So Janet Parsons, who is Sandy's, there's so many names, Sandy Parsons, the adoptive dad of Erica. So Janet Parsons is Sandy's stepmother and Casey's mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. Okay. So she also testified that for a time in 2011, everyone had lived together in her China Grove home. And Erica, according to Janet, wasn't treated as kindly as the others. She had to do more chores. She was kind of like a little Cinderella, which mm-hmm. I believe you have an interesting mm-hmm. psych tie into that. She had to do the chores. In one incident in particular, Casey and the rest of the family left and went to the beach, and they just left Erica in the house alone, which, speak of Cinderella. Mm-hmm. And Janet, no one knew Erica was even there, and Erica just kind of popped up. We had no knowledge she was there, which is scary if you think about it. Janet Parsons testified she was hidden. So just those sorts of things where when they would go out, so even if discounting the actual physical abuse, they would leave her in the house
but
like a dog.
But at some point,
Janet
say, why isn't Erica here?
Well, why didn't the sisters?
Oh my God.
Yeah, no, that's just what I'm saying. This is where the complicity, now not complicit to the point where like the siblings were, but mm-hmm. complicity, you're still complicit, I'm sorry, if you don't fucking do something and you know
like
what's
if I go to my my mom
girl.
And my you know stepdad take me and my brother and my grandparents' house and my brother's not there, they're gonna be like, where is Adam?
Right.
They're gonna
any
they
normal person
oh
yeah
my God.
So that's the kind of shit that was happening. So
which might also to explain why Sandy and Casey are so fucked up themselves, really.
Oh yeah, I would say there is a long line of just complete fuckery mm-hmm. in terms of family lineage going back a long, long ways. And the sad part is, I'm sure it will probably continue mm-hmm. because think of all their biological kids that witnessed all this, participated,
yes.
and are gonna like carry it
forward. And I do have studies
forward.
On that. I have studies yeah. on what happens on the psychology of these kids who are forced or willingly participate in the abuse. What happens to them when they grow up? So I have a study on that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So let's go through James, and then that'll be a really good segue mm-hmm. into if you can shed any light on why this happened. So once all the investigatory stuff was happening, obviously James, who again is Erica's adoptive brother, so in 2013, he's the one that basically blew the whistle. So to get to the bottom of the story of like, where was Erica? What happened? James told police that he hadn't seen Erica in 2 years. And the last time he saw Erica, she had been stood in the corner for punishment, which, again, was a very usual thing. And he said, quote, she didn't look too good. She looked like a zombie. She said she did not feel good. She said she could not breathe too good. James said Erica was gone the next morning, and he never saw her again. That was it. His parents had left early that day, which was weird for them. They had come back to the house around 9 a.m. They told him Erica had gone to live with this mythological biological grandmother that didn't exist, but something didn't seem right to him. And he said, Mama looked normal. Daddy looked sick, like he was about to throw up. Mama went on her recliner with the computer. Daddy, it was a blank stare. Those are his
white
verbatim.
Trash.
Like, the language mm-hmm. and the... I don't want to get my story. Mm-hmm. So when they were like, why did you wait almost 2 years to report that your sister was gone? James Parsons said, for one thing, he didn't know if anybody would believe him.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
Which I understand mm-hmm. from my background. I get that. I understand that. I just got enough guts to go to the police, he said. But part of that, too, there was a big physical altercation between James and Sandy and Casey.
Well, something, yeah.
To the point where he was charged. Now, whether she lied and fabricated that, I don't know. And she didn't show up to court then when he was actually called in for that.
Because even in the Likens case, like when their parents did come to visit them at one point, and Jenny, her biological sister, mm-hmm. who... interestingly, the only biological connection there does try to stick up for her yeah. sister, doesn't participate in shit.
Right.
But neither Sylvia nor Jenny said anything. And the same thing with James not saying anything. It's like, why don't they do that? And I think Lainey mentioned, you know, why didn't they speak up? And she mm-hmm. kind of explains, you know, there was probably a couple of reasons. But yeah, why didn't James go sooner? So here, he's an adult now. He didn't just like, get this, caring, like, strong beating heart and run to the police and tell them. He actually just got a fight with his parents. He was probably pissed off.
Well, and he left. Like, he wasn't living there. Mm-hmm. And so, and I in no way trying to, like, excuse or justify, but I do, just from my own experience, like, I do understand the secrecy aspect. Mm-hmm. And, like, and as an adult, there's many times now where I would think, why didn't I just, as a kid, like, call the police? Mm-hmm. But it never would have occurred to me. And I can't even explain that. There's just this weird indoctrination that, like, that's mm-hmm. the family shit. Those are the family secrets. That's our business. You don't tell anybody.
Or even maybe, you're like, there's afraid. A little bit of normalcy and also, like, yeah, fear. Like,
yeah, you're very afraid. Much fear.
As, you know, I think Lainey mentioned with Sylvia and Jenny, you know, would anyone even believe them?
Right. And then so the retaliation. Even, yeah.
Right. The retaliation. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the retaliation,
so
you're going to get.
There's many reasons.
Yeah. So, like, I have a lot of empathy for, you know, not doing the disclosure. But I totally understand how on the outside it does seem absolutely criminal that you wouldn't go and report it, that you would let this happen, much less what James did. So let me get into what James, that's
I was
not,
gonna say, we have to,
yeah, if that was all, yeah,
than not
if that
telling.
Was all, then that would be one thing, but mm-hmm. yeah, so it gets a lot worse. So James basically revealed then, Erica had just been put through hell. Mm-hmm. I mean, she really did. James, so now he's 21 when he's reporting this, said that he and the other children in the family routinely abused her. James himself said he once broke her arm. I would hit her, physically abuse her using fists and belts, he said. He said he abused her from the time he was age 5 and stopped when he was 16 because I didn't want to hit her no more. Excuse me, I couldn't stand it.
So he wasn't enjoying this.
I mean, I have some empathy for him. I mean, I would never, like, in that situation, you know, just myself and my sister in a dysfunctional household, like, I would never have participated
in beating her.
In beating her.
And breaking
but
her arms.
I have complicity that I was an older sister, and I, you know what I mean? Like,
they're very different.
You know,
different.
I know it is, but I'm just like, oh. So, yeah, something, again, they're raised in this environment. Like, it's just, it's so bad. Mm-hmm. So, on top of that, obviously, he's learning this behavior. And like we said, he was encouraged to do this. Like,
and after
very
that
much
long, like I said, maybe it did become a little normal to do.
Well, part of the dysfunction does become the normative. But again, no way excusing this. It's fucking horrible. In terms of what Casey and Sandy would do, Casey seemed to be the aggressor most of the time, the mm-hmm. mom. So, he often saw Casey beat Erica. She would beat her with a belt. Mama would bend her fingers back. Again, the thing about Erica's hand getting put in a cast because Casey had broken her fingers.
The mom also, like, choked her and locked her in a closet.
Yep. Dad would hit her on the fist at the top of his head. She had a bald spot because they would smash her with a belt buckle on top of her head.
Oh, my God.
Like, she lost her hair. Food was withheld. If she'd steal a cookie or something, she would be force-fed, like, canned dog food. And then she was locked in the closet. So, like, later when they started ripping the house apart, they found basically just urine stained everywhere in the closet.
A whole other vein, too, is this, like, food is a major central issue in every single, like, severe child abuse case.
Yeah.
It is a major thing. Like, Lainey said, too, I mean, the worst thing, I think, in Lycan's case that Lainey mentioned, was that they would make her eat her own excrement and urine, and then she'd throw up and make her own vomit.
Right.
Which is literally, like, the worst thing. I mean, that was the worst part. About the whole case. Well, actually, no, it's not.
It's pretty bad, but
the whole thing with her vagina was horrible.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's like a major mm-hmm. source of power for the parent with mm-hmm. the food. And all these kids are generally malnourished. And so they have this, I read about other cases where, you know, as adults, they still have to hoard food.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they need,
compulsory, yeah.
You know, when they're in their normal bedrooms now, they need to have, like, a source
a stash
of food near them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because it can be taken away. And again, it feeds into that fear, and you are vulnerable, and I can starve you out. I can punish you through. So sustenance, you know, it does become this really horrific just control mechanism. And I just, not that they're, I mean, obviously this isn't the oppression Olympics, and we can't really compare and contrast Sylvia and Erica and who had it worse. And that's not the goal or the objective.
Oh, no.
But, like, I just, when you look at Erica's picture and you think about, not only is it bad enough, just the basic circumstances, but to have developmental disabilities, be partially deaf, and just be the most vulnerable thing you could ever be, and, like, what they did to her, I just...
And same with Sylvia.
God.
Sylvia was, like, left by her family.
Abandoned.
Like, she was so vulnerable, too. Obviously, Erica is a little bit different, but, yeah, I mean, these adults are taking the most vulnerable child, or the prettiest child, mm-hmm. or the one that resent, like, there's, they always scapegoat one of them for very similar stupid reasons, yeah. like, oh, you look like your mother, I'm gonna beat you. It's right. just, it's insane.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Erica, she had some
no
issues.
No recourse. Yeah.
I know. Like, she had no way to defend herself at all.
Not at all. Like, it's just, it's so fucking fucked. So back to, we're just talking about the being locked in the closet. So
and can I just quick say, too, with child abuse cases, that this is a lot of the, not a lot, but a good portion of child abuse cases are with someone that, a child that has a disability. Like, that's not unheard of at all.
People are fucking pieces of shit, and they're,
And then parents will be like later, like, oh, I was really overwhelmed.
I was so stressed, yeah.
Like, what do you think your fucking kid felt like?
I know.
Anyway, but yeah,
it's criminal. It's literally.
It's like the runt of the litter, like, that's the one, you know, so.
I'm going to attack you and prey on you, mm-hmm. and, yeah, it's just.
Torture you, basically, until you die.
So, when the FBI was investigating everything, they took carpet and wallboard from the closet, like
you
said.
Saw those images.
Sent that, yeah, so, urine,
there was
saliva.
Pictures of them taking mattresses out with gas masks on and shit.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Because, again, I mean, she was I'm sure the dogs they were raising were treated, obviously, a million times better than Erica ever was. This really disturbed me. 5 photos of Erica were recovered from a computer in the house. All of Erica standing in a corner on different days. Like, they had to fucking document that, like some Blair Witch shit. Like,
I was
it wasn't
just
enough
say
to make
that.
Her do it, right? Oh, God,
that
just
is really
stuck in
creepy.
My head.
This poor little girl. Oh,
it's
my God.
It's so creepy. I know.
This poor little girl.
I know. So, clearly, I mean, I don't even know what else to say in terms of the abuse mm-hmm. and what happened mm-hmm. to her. I mean, it's just completely, and the wrap up to that story, I mean, things are still going on right now. I mean, there's a whole thing, I won't really get into it, but I can link this in the show notes. While she was still missing in air quotes, Casey and Sandy went on the Dr. Phil show. And if you want to see a goddamn travesty and just the most immoral people you've ever seen in your life sit there and lie through their teeth about the fabricated grandmother. Yes, poorly. The stupidity of mm-hmm. Sandy, the father, kind of being like, well, and Dr. Phil's a total piece of shit too, but whatever. All that aside. Dr. Phil's like, so Sandy, do you not care? Like, did you not question what was happening? And he's like, well, basically, I listen to what she says, and, you know, meaning Casey. Like,
why
it's
would
just,
you go on the Dr. Phil show?
And be grilled.
Like,
I know.
Like, why would you?
And just completely, patently, obviously lie, blatantly.
Like, why would you go on the Dr. Phil show? Like, wouldn't you want to hide? Like, wouldn't
you
want to
see, that shows to me that they just wanted that gratification, that attention, and they're, like, that's
Casey
really
did.
Evil. Just kind of acquiesces to whatever because, you
Which
know.
Which is even worse, really.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's just, that is such, that Dr. Phil episode is just absolutely crazy, the things that they say. And the one last thing I want to say about Casey, too, that's relevant, is previous to this, Casey had a little stint as a surrogate mother, mm-hmm. which, yeah, great, mother of the year material. Mm-hmm. And essentially, she promised this baby she, you know, contracted with a client to bear the kid for her to the tune of $10,000. And then a few weeks into the pregnancy, she lied and told the client that, oh, sorry, baby miscarried. And that wasn't true.
What happened to
the
baby?
She carried the baby to term, and she was keeping it. And the client had no idea. She believed her, right? She believed Casey that there was a miscarriage. And then apparently one of Casey's relatives blew the whistle on that, and it got back to the client. So then they had this protracted legal battle to get. Because it was...
Did the client get that
The client
kid?
Got the kid
Thank
back,
fucking
eventually.
God.
Yeah, but that was this whole...
Thank God.
Yeah. So, if that tells you anything just about the inner pathology, mm-hmm. right, and the way that she is, it's just... I just can't even... Yeah, so bad. So, the way it is now, both parents are serving time, but not for the murder. Again, we haven't had the formal charge of the murder at this point, at least not that's been released to us, because they just found her mm-hmm. in September. So they're both serving time in separate prisons because of basically ripping the state off and getting these benefits mm-hmm. for the girl that they no doubt murdered, mm-hmm. right? So that's the basic genesis of what happened and where she is. And so we just really wanted to kind of talk about why. Not that there's an answer, but it's just one of those things that it's so mind-boggling.
So in both the Erica Parsons and Sylvia Likens case, we see basically the Cinderella effect.
Yeah.
The Cinderella effect, it's like an evolutionary psychology term. It's basically looks at the alleged higher incidence or different forms of child abuse and mistreatment by step parents or surrogate parents or adoptive parents than biological parents. So when we look at child abuse, we see such a higher rate of kids being abused by step parents or adoptive parents, and that's called the Cinderella effect. And it basically takes its name from the fairy tale character Cinderella. And it's described, psychologists describe the effect as a remnant of an adaptive reproductive strategy among primates in male, in which males frequently kill the offspring of other males in order to bring their mothers into estrus and give the male a chance to fertilize her himself. And this is both supporting evidence for this theory and criticism against it. So essentially what that means is, like, if that's not your biological child, you don't feel the desire to invest in them as much as you would your own children because they're not going to keep the seed going. So it's like you don't care about a kid that's not yours as much as you do your own kids. Which
and in
totally
fact,
makes
maybe
sense.
It's viewed as an additional burden. You know what I mean? And an additional thing where you're not, you're not going to get the long-term benefit if you're crazy and that's how you fucking think. But
And the fact that this happens is a fact, whether you look at why, you know, there's been many studies looking at like battered children. One was done in 1973 and it looked at fatal battered baby cases. And 52% of those children that were killed by their stepfathers.
Wow, that's crazy.
I mean, like, not mom, not dad, not stepmom, stepfathers.
Wow.
More than half. So there is definite validity. There's many other studies we don't have time for. But there's validity of the Cinderella effect all over the world. And the evidence from the fact that this exists is from evidence of child abuse and homicide studies, official reports on child abuse, clinical data, victim reports, official homicide data. And all these studies conclude that stepchildren, and these were mostly studies were done in Canada, Great Britain, and the United States. Indeed, it does incur a greatly elevated risk of child maltreatment of various sorts, including lethal beatings by a step parent or adoptive parent. So I think that we see this here. Also because there were other children. And when abusive parents have both step and genetic children, they usually spare their genetic children, which happens here.
Spares not in these,
So in such families, stepchildren were exclusively targeted 9 out of 10 times, you know, when we look at child abuse cases and who the kid was that got abused. So I have so much study on that. I will just keep going. what this comes down to is this was something that was kind of controversial in the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s even, whether abuse victims, again, stepchildren or adoptive, if they were scapegoated. So did they only target one kid or were they abusing other kids? And essentially, you know, generally with families like this that have blended children, the parents, it's now confirmed, do actually focus, if they're going to be abusive, they focus all of their rage on one child or a scapegoat. So that's, you know, now fact. And so the other siblings, obviously, parents usually will force their own kids to become either emotionally numb or hostile towards the abuse victim or the scapegoated child. And like in James's case, and Jenny, really, brothers and sisters of abused children, they often do like suffer lifelong emotional scars because they help their parents conceal the abuse.
Heyo!
Or in extreme cases, they were forced to participate in torturing their siblings. You know, and you know, there's other, you know, reasons. But, you know, especially in the Journal of Emotional Abuse, I found a lot of stuff on the siblings because they call them non-abused siblings, by the way. That's a key term. And so these studies actually looked at the children that were remaining. And it basically, they find that when they, because they're basically trained as kids to not feel empathy for the targeted child and maybe others, that generally they grow up without this ability to process empathy, and they call it empathy deficit. And then I actually did find that study. It's called Empathy Deficits in Children of Severely Scapegoated Children, a Conceptual Model. And I'm just going to look at the abstract of this. Well, I could look at more. I do have some pages tagged, but basically, the study looks at one form of maltreatment. It often includes both physical and emotional abuse, targets one child in the family, referred to as a scapegoat. And historically, the scapegoat has been regarded as the only abuse victim. And many families, siblings identify with the parent, joining and blaming the victim for the caretaker's abuse of the child. They grow up to basically demonstrate empathy deficits, which may protect them from the effects of witnessing the process. And this is actually...
But does that devolve into, like, sociopathy, does that suggest?
Well...
Like, is this a rationale for, like, some of our serial killers and our issues?
They don't make that connection, but I would hope there's studies on that.
I mean, it would kind of make sense. Or, at least for a small percentage, you know.
Well, I mean, when you think empathy deficit, you think sociopath. There's so many other things in there.
Totally.
That make one a sociopath, and also there's still that debate, which I don't think is really a debate. Are they born or made?
Yeah. But if you're inculcated to do violence, and you dehumanize the scapegoat a child, so then do they grow up, and then maybe they're going to scapegoat and dehumanize their victim because it doesn't matter. In their minds, they're equating it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's acceptable for... like, whatever they perceive to be of lower value.
Absolutely.
But anyways, go ahead. That's interesting.
No, that totally makes sense. So, just a little bit more, I do want to talk about just a couple things, because there are so many things that do explain why these children engage in abusing their sibling. So, again, scapegoating, it can actually be very gratifying and self-reinforcing for everyone but the recipient, obviously. It provides justification for them to vent their anger, hatred, and aggression under the guise of trying to change the victim from bad to good. And this happens a lot. They see that kid as bad or not right, or she gets on my nerves, or, you know, whatever the excuse is.
And they're encouraged to help discipline, as in these two cases.
So, yeah, they're abusing them because they want them to be better, right?
Clearly, yeah.
So if the child is bad, the logic goes, then the punishment is necessary to teach that child to be good. The adult perpetrator transmits the view to the rest of the family, and there is pressure for them to adopt that same viewpoint. So then the siblings who join in with the perpetrator are not only elevated in the family system, but they gain a feeling of safety. So that's really interesting.
Well, and I'm sure you also want to ensure that your place as the non-beaten and burnt and finger-broken one, that you keep that. You know, you have to keep that hierarchy stable, and it just keeps feeding into you escalate and escalate and escalate.
Absolutely. And so the parent, there are, you know, there's some proposals in this study that the parent figures, they're compete with one another and their children for attention, or they compete, I'm sorry, with one another and their children for attention and nurture. When the parent or the adult's stress reaches a critical point, these parents will target one child who fails to gratify their needs. So that child is not gratifying their needs or how they feel about themselves. The scapegoat then becomes the focus of the parent's projection, a process that occurs when the adult projects unacceptable attributes onto the victim child. And the child who meets the parent's needs are good, while the child who is not narcissistically gratifying to them is bad. And as they watch the mistreatment, these siblings may initially attempt to reach out to the victim, but quickly they learn that empathetic behavior is not a safe recourse. So the caregiver swiftly brings the other children into the family, into the conspiracy to isolate, humiliate, and terrorize the scapegoat. And I have lots of stars around this next section. The siblings' compliance with the process offers secondary gains and may impair their developing empathy skills as they grow up. The siblings, first observing, then participating in the process, become victims of emotional abuse, obviously, the least visible and acknowledged form of child maltreatment, which I was like, ding, 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 ding. Because emotional abuse... I've experienced that many times. And it is, you can't see it, you know. And so, again, it's the least visible and acknowledged form of child abuse. So these kids are also obviously being abused emotionally by seeing this, by feeling that need to engage in it in order to feel safe themselves. And they're obviously brainwashed that this kid is bad. So the developmental stages of the scapegoat siblings are impacted by witnessing and participating in their siblings' maltreatment. The siblings become emotionally numb towards the victim as a result of their own vicarious trauma, emotional abuse. Avoidance of disturbing thoughts and feelings is one of the core responses to trauma. Just a couple other things. The scapegoated child is often more sensitive or more vulnerable than the other children. Erica Parsons. And alternatively, you can see, yes. he or she may have some disability, mental or physical illness, learning disability, or developmental delay that is problematic for the family. So, again, the scapegoated child has rejected, basically is rejected because they have something wrong with them. It seems something wrong with them.
And just, not to interrupt, but I feel really obtuse now that we didn't But, like, Larry, like, hello, right?
Yeah.
So, and I won't go to this whole thing, and you can listen to past episodes and whatever, but I have an adopted brother, but, I mean, all the parallels in terms of being adopted,
yeah,
having learning disabilities and delays, the food thing, right? Like, he was starved as a kid. He had compulsory food issues. Mm-hmm. Very much scapegoated from his adoptive parents.
Yes.
He wasn't performing in school. He couldn't do things appropriately. I mean, again, it's like, it just completely, completely lines up. But in that case, mm-hmm, the parents kind of were taken care of because Larry ended up stabbing and killing them.
And this is one of the reasons that we wanted to start our podcast, is to find...
Exactly.
Because we just arbitrarily talk about this shit all the time.
Because we're creeps, and it's, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
But we are, like, I have found so many patterns, mm-hmm, like, between everything we've ever done, and this is another one. You know, again, this other child, the other child, like, adopted child, like, Larry, like, Erica, Sylvia, by proxy, mm-hmm, you know, there's one set of rules for the rest of the kids, and then there's another set for the bad kid. And that child will respond by acting out, right? Because they're being treated differently,
yeah,
if they're being bad. And this confirms the family view of that child, that they're acting out.
It becomes a self-fulfilling bullshit prophecy.
And triggers some form of punishment. The more the child is punished, the more he or she behaves in ways to elicit punishment, accepting the evaluation of himself as bad or damaged, mm-hmm, and deserving of maltreatment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which might be the saddest thing of all of this,
mm-hmm,
you know, because then you just internalize it and you're like, well, I guess I am. I guess I am a horrible piece of shit and I deserve this punishment. It's just an indoctrination. Like, how do you not fall into that pattern?
So I have a lot more. I know, I'm sorry, I'm like really into this. So I'm just going to keep going. When we look, now, like I started out saying, what happens to these siblings like James or Jenny, that what happens to them as they get older?
Mm-hmm.
So the value of empathy, and that's empathy is, again, having feelings for other people, has been established. It's a crucial element that defines you as a caring human being and eventually maybe a caring parent.
And the difference, can we say, like, so sympathy is feeling sorry for someone,
yeah,
right?
It's the ability to enter into another person's feelings,
right, you
thoughts.
Feel with them as opposed to feeling sorry for them.
Right.
Just, I mean, it's a much more broader, all-encompassing, it's a very human thing.
Absolutely. Makes you human, really.
Right, right.
And when the development of empathy is disrupted, and this, again, confirms my belief, solid belief that, you know, sociopaths and things like that, those are people that are made, not born. You're not born that way. So this further confirms that when their development of empathy is disrupted as a child, for even the best case scenario, it produces an emotionally immature person.
Mm-hmm.
And nature equips humans with a capacity for empathy, confirming my theory, because newborns react to their mother's happy or sad facial reactions with similar expressions.
Right.
They mimic it. And children visibly react to other people's pain or happiness, even at the ages of 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
So the parent's role in this development is not only to serve as a model, but to demonstrate respect for the child as a separate person with his own thoughts, feelings, and needs, which the Parsons, oh my God.
No, yeah.
Like,
your thing, yeah.
So if you even think about that mimicking thing, if that, they're the model,
you get the antithesis,
mm-hmm,
of that, right? So
absolutely. And so when the parent lacks empathy, the risk for child maltreatment cases escalates dramatically. So sociopaths, right?
Yeah.
They risk being an abusive parent. And in this particular form of child maltreatment that targets only one child's scapegoat, the empathy deficit appears to be transmitted to the siblings, who often will display little or no empathy for the scapegoat, which is, I think, incredibly interesting.
It's such a virus, right? It's very,
mm-hmm,
very, like, it's like the parents are the vector of the disease, right? And then
absolutely,
it's just perpetuated throughout the non, you know, disciplined siblings. That's terrifying.
And I won't get into this, but there is absolutely no way I can conclude without bringing up Zimbardo or Milgram, and they're like, you know, groundbreaking studies. I've taught these in my classes.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, is looking into the siblings' behavior. So just Zimbardo simulated prison study. I know we all probably know about that. You know, you have people that kind of, the behavior of the individual is shaped by the demands of the environment,
mm-hmm,
the brutalizing effects on prisoners by other guards, blah, blah, blah. And Milgram's study, too, he did the shocks, right?
Right, right.
So his study regarded the influence of authority and obedience. And he concluded that the level of obedience correlated greatly with the legitimacy of the authority figure and social pressure, and, of course, in combination with the individual's personality.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little bit on Milgram and Zimbardo's studies. The individual was able, in a group context, to distance his or herself from the actions or the impact of the victim. The effect was different when another authority figure contradicted the scapegoater, and unfortunately, scapegoating adults often choose passive spouses. For this reason, so there is no other available adult model for that child.
Yeah.
So again, looking at Sandy and Casey Parsons, she chose a passive
custody. Yeah, textbook example.
And this also goes into attribution theory. It's useful in understanding the sibling's response to the victim. Siblings often attribute the parent's cruel behavior as an intervention designed to make the victim, again, a better person and save that child from a failed life.
Oh, God.
So, again, a lot of times siblings will form an alliance with the parent. Boundaries between the generations blur. The siblings are elevated in status again. Scapegoating families tend to be enmeshed, very closely locked together in the misery of inflicting unmerited blame and punishment on one of their members. Any attempt to differentiate from the family is viewed as a threat and dealt with promptly. So, there is no, like, model to understand how children become emotionally sensitive towards their targeted sibling. But, I mean, these are some things that we can kind of look at. I actually have a lot of case studies, which I totally won't go into because I know I went over my limit. But this kind of explains why, and you can see there's actually numbers here, like, why does this happen?
Mm-hmm.
Again, the scapegoating parent is often needy. They're hostile. They hate themselves. The victim looks or behaves differently. So again, look like, you know, someone you're jealous of or another, you know, another parent. And the victim is, again, blamed for not reflecting the goodness of that parent. I mean, it goes on. There's like a literal list here.
Yeah.
So, this is not so common, but it's happened enough that we actually have models
right
for what happens. Like, it's kind of textbook, this shit all happens, it's all the same. You know, and what it comes back to is you have a parent who basically is needy, they hate themselves, they're evil, essentially.
They're evil as fuck.
You know, they have major issues.
When they lack control, right, in their own life, probably. I'm sure they're losers.
Oh, none of these are
no
CEOs.
Success.
These aren't CEOs.
Right.
So I mean,
where can you
scumbags.
Exceed control? Well, you can, you know, fuck the kid up, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that even going back historically to oral folk tales, and like you mentioned with Cinderella, the fact that that's named after that, this is not a new occurrence, right? Like you said, it's not that every abuse case necessarily is this particular type, but it's that idea of, I think, really being othered as the child that, like you said, is either adopted or brought in for whatever reason, and they don't belong. I mean, going back to the literal Cinderella, it's that kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why it's so important. It is such a cliche to talk about, like, breaking this cycle. But it literally is a huge-ass cycle that continues and continues and continues. And just think about if they hadn't killed Erica, or if they hadn't, I mean, I feel like Sylvia, I don't know, I think that's a little bit different, and I don't know, like, how she would have come out of that had she not been murdered.
She was trying her goddamnedest to get out. And it's a little bit different because Sylvia suffered abuse over a shorter amount of time than Erica, even though that doesn't
And there were strangers, coming in. I mean, it's not
I'm not saying, like, oh, the abuse. I mean, it's just a little bit different.
No, we're not, we're not trying to, you know, equal one as the other one's worse, whatever, that's not the point.
I mean, when Lainey was talking about how Sylvia's, like, strength, like, she fought. Erica didn't even have a chance.
No.
But, like, Sylvia fought, and when they tried to give her that food before they killed her, she's like, feed it to the dog.
Yeah.
They're hungrier than I am.
Yeah.
Like, I mean.
Which just kills. Oh, God. That kills. It hurts.
So, you know, to kind of, like, contribute, right, we along with Lainey have decided, you want to talk about.
Yeah, just because, you know, obviously, again, this is something that if you have a heart, it's really going to get to you. And because, like you were saying with emotional abuse, and, you know, you certainly didn't have the most perfect of childhoods. And y'all know my business, if you know, whatever, because my business is all over the internet.
If you've had a step-parent or an adoptive, not necessarily adoptive per se, but I mean, you're
just a psychopathic
feel that,
parent.
Yeah,
I mean,
you feel that, you even if you're not physically abused, you do feel that difference, that otherness, that you're not good enough.
Right.
I mean, that's, I see that all, I mean, that's not uncommon at all.
Yeah.
So,
You know, if you've experienced that, if you've experienced actual physical abuse, sexual abuse, what have you, which sadly is way too many people. So we just wanted to do a little something, and this is just a drop in the ocean, but just to feel, you know, our own little sense that we were doing something. Lainey and Jamie and I, on behalf of Bone Palace Ballet and True Crime Fan Club podcast, are just going to make a donation to Prevent Child Abuse America, which is a really highly rated nonprofit charity where the money actually goes to many different subsets of organizations within that larger umbrella to help with educational programs, which is where it really kind of needs to start, right? Mm-hmm. So if any listeners would be interested in donating as well, obviously that would be great.
It could even be like a dollar.
Yeah, just something. I mean, this is just kind of symbolic in honor of both Sylvia and Erica. I mean, you know.
Because so, these are kids. It's like so different from anything we've really done on air.
Yeah.
That, you know, you kind of have to feel moved to like just do something.
Yeah. So if you want to register that, you can go to preventchildabuse.org. And I know we'd really appreciate it. And the organization would really appreciate
it. And Lainey would too.
As well. Yes. Lainey definitely would.
So, this concludes our, our
crossover.
Yeah. And I really liked it, honestly. I think I thought Lainey's episode was awesome.
So
I was riveted. Yeah. She was so like precise. And, it kind of, and the fact that we had a case that kind of matched, and now we can tie these together with studies, was really cool that we could kind of bring it all together.
See that pattern, and
absolutely.
And we wanted to work with Lainey just because, for me, I know like her first episode that she ever did was on Albert Fish.
Yeah.
So I was like, homegirl is not playing around. Like to come out of the gate with Albert Fish, like that's you have my respect there. So. True Crime Fan Club is a great podcast. Mm-hmm. You guys should definitely check it out.
It's one of our favorite, absolutely.
Yeah, we don't want to miss that.
Mm-hmm.
So a great thing to do for True Crime Fan Club podcast would be to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. And you can do the same for us at Bone Palace Ballet.
So if you want to follow Lainey, the True Crime Fan Club podcast, you can follow her on Twitter at TCFCpod. You can also contact her or follow her on Facebook.com at TCFC podcast, and then truecrimefanclub.com is another place that you can go.
That's her website.
Yep. If you want to email Lainey and her podcast, you can email her at tcfcpod@gmail.com. Now, do you want to give us some props?
So,
TCFC, TCFC.
If you want to do any of the same things for us, except for Facebook, because I've just given up
on
Facebook.
Yeah, we're not.
We're just over it.
Like, we're on Twitter all the time.
We're on
obviously.
Twitter. So you can tweet us there.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At Bone Ballet Pod, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can email us your suggestions or whatever you want at boneballetpodcast@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can also rate, review, subscribe to us on iTunes. We would greatly appreciate it.
And if you like Lainey's podcast, you'll like ours. And if you like our podcast, you'll definitely like Lainey's.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of like we want to just kind of share the love and like share, there's another podcast you can listen to out there that's like pretty awesome.
With a strong woman who's intelligent and tells a hell of a story. And definitely, if you're listening to this, this is very directly relevant to your interest and you want to subscribe to both these newsletters, basically.
Absolutely. Right? Yep. All right. So that concludes our, our mashup.
Power hour.
We'll be back shortly with another episode. And of course, you will keep updated with Lainey's episodes as well. And we'll see you guys soon.
Thanks, guys.